olives and cheese, and we started talking about our marriages. I told him that Lana is Jewish. I have a joke in my act about the Italian-Jewish connection. Same corporation, different divisions. And Jerry suggested I call her so he could say hello. I phoned Lana and put her on speaker. By the tone of her voice, I could tell she was surprised and a bit flustered. It goes up a few octaves when she's nervous. My wife is very supportive of what I do, as well as a huge part of it. The ostensible reason Jerry had suggested the call was, I'm a Jew, she's a Jew, let's have a Jew talk. But I think he knew how much the day meant to me, and that involving my wife would give Lana and me a shared memory, something to savor together later on. Last time I was in New York, Jerry and I went to a dinner at Milos, a Greek restaurant on West 55th Street, and one of my favorite places to go in the city. We were joined by the Mazzilli brothers and George Wallace, a comedian. If I invite you to dinner, it's a rule for me to pick up the tab. I don't care who the hell you are. I invited Jerry and the whole group to my favorite restaurant, so it was on me. My dad always carries around a huge knot of bills pulled from the ceiling, even now when everyone uses cards. He'll say, what if the credit card don't work? You have to have the amount of cash in your pocket to cover whatever you're going to eat. That was instilled in me from the get-go. Always carry cash. And when you have a wad of bills, it's easy to pay for dinner without having a big commotion about it and without having to wait for the check to be brought back. And nowadays, the need to check your credit card statement to make sure the place didn't rob you or steal your identity. A lot of people wait until the check is dropped and then hesitate long enough for someone else to grab it. You have a big song and dance. If you really want to pay for your bill, you give the credit card to the guy before you even sit down. Thank you, Scott Luckert. Just say, make sure the bill goes on this card. Or you do what I did. After we finished, I got up as if to go to the bathroom and asked the waiter, can you bring the bill to me off to the side? I went back to the table and said we could go. Someone asked, what about the bill? Taken care of, I said. Sometimes, like that night, there might be a protest, as in, what are you doing? You don't have to do that. Oh, but I do. Especially if my companion paid the last time. Jerry insisted on picking it up when we had dinner at Mozza in L.A. It was not only my invitation, it was my turn. I'm sure he'll get another chance to wrestle me for the bill. It's been 3 years since I made fun of Jerry's scarf at Gotham, and now I consider him a friend. We bonded over our two favorite things, food and comedy. My best friends aren't part of comedy at all. They're from the old days, high school and college. They're working class guys, real estate agents, house painters, money managers. They've been with me this whole time. When they used to come to my shows out of town, we were all so broke we'd share one hotel room. So now I get comped enough rooms at a casino for all of them to have their own, plus a steak dinner too. I love to share what I'm doing with my family and friends. That's where I get my enjoyment. No matter what, I could count on these guys to keep me grounded and rip me to shreds. These days, we're in better hotel rooms, but the relationships haven't changed. People could get a big head in this business. Yes, I have an actual big head physically, but I'm so turned off by big egos. There are no guarantees in comedy, and I've noticed that the bigger the people's heads, the more they lose sight of the reason they're here in the first place. I love what I do, and that's important to me. I keep my head down and just do what I have been doing for the last 19 years, booking gigs, traveling, and working on my material. I picked up some momentum, but it's happened over a long time. It's not like I was doing bowling alleys yesterday and today at Caesar's Palace. Every year, my road has gotten smoother. More people come out to see me. More opportunities are cropping up. The progress had been so gradual that when I glance at the speedometer, I'm shocked to see that I'm doing 110. It's my tendency to be observant, but not necessarily introspective. When I take time to slow down and reflect, like looking in the rearview mirror of life, or writing a book about the road I've traveled, It only makes me want to turn back around, face forward, and go faster. I have a deep-seated fear of resting in one place. No amount of validation, even from Jerry Seinfeld, is going to make me feel complacent, slow down, or stop. My wife says that I'm superstitious about it. If I were ever to say to myself, wow, you're doing great, it'd be a jinx. She's right. I do believe that if I relish in my success at all, even for a minute, I'd hit a wall and it would all be over. I'll probably never relax about where I am or where I'm headed. In the long run, which hopefully we're all on, I don't want to be built for comfort like a Cadillac. I don't care about being built for speed like a Camaro. I want to be built to last like a Camry. Chapter 11. Chip. Lana and I started trying to have a baby right after a vacation in Greece and Turkey. We felt we needed to get some travel under our belts before jumping into parenthood. Lana got pregnant immediately. We couldn't believe it. We'd just begun trying. We were over the moon. We wanted to tell everybody, but we knew about the rule that you should wait 12 weeks before you share the news because of a possibility of a miscarriage. We were too excited, though. We couldn't hold off. We arrived in Naples for Christmas at her parents' house. Her whole family was there, and it seemed a shame to wait another month and a half to tell them over the phone when we could make the big announcement in person. The only issue was that she was so early on, and the doctor was a little hesitant about whether it was going to be a viable pregnancy. But we said screw it, and felt optimistic. The idea was to tell our families by catching them off guard with some kind of clever Photoshopped meme. I could have recycled the mailing I sent to agents and directors when I arrived in L.A. Something like that. Coming soon. Baby Maniscalco. But I come a long way since then, and now I had better ideas, and just the guy to pull it off. Steve Matrano makes my memes for social media accounts to publicize gigs and podcasts by transposing my head into recognizable settings and in strange situations. I didn't find Steve. He found me. He would share his memes of me on social media, and they caught my eye. They were so well done, spot on, and funny. When I started noticing and loving his work, I thought Steve was just a fan with phenomenal talent. In fact, he's an Emmy-winning graphic artist in the news field. He was just doing memes of me for fun. I was really impressed that he could combine his talent with my comedy to make these incredible images, and I had to make him part of my team. Lana said, "Hey, Mom, look at this new thing Sebastian's doing." We often shared all sorts of career stuff with Lana's family, so it didn't seem unusual for me to pull up an image on the computer to show them. They looked at the meme of Lana painting a picture of a baby whose face was a combination of our features. I was expecting cheers, tears, an emotional explosion. My wife's family was definitely excited, but their reaction was subdued, like, "Congrats! Great news!" Over the next week, Lana had some signs that the pregnancy might not be a go. I'll spare you the details, but since we shared the news with her family, and we wanted to remain optimistic, we decided to tell my family, too. Everyone was going to be together in L.A. for New Year's, so we would do it then. We pulled the same trick on my family with the meme. Their reaction was just a little different from Lana's family. My father did his signature laugh yell that comes out in every emotional scenario because he doesn't know how to respond. It's just a lot of teeth. My mom screamed, rattling the windows with the volume. Jessica yelled, like mother, like daughter, right before she started crying, which set off Talia, my 5-year-old niece. She was so startled at the intense volume of my sister's voice, she threw herself on the couch crying. Then I started crying too, because it's how I do. Everyone in the house was hugging, weeping, jumping up and down, clapping like they had just won an all-expense-paid trip to Jamaica on Family Feud. A lot of shit went down in the living room. Lana was a bit quiet, because at this point, she was feeling pretty hesitant that everything was okay. She was right. A week later, Lana wasn't feeling well. We Googled her symptoms and it was okay, unless it got worse. Over the course of the day, however, we couldn't write off what was happening to her as normal. We moved into call your doctor immediately territory. Losing that pregnancy was hard, and we grieved, but we both took comfort in the idea that this particular one, for whatever the reason, was not meant to be. As far as miscarriages go, it was the best of all possible situations. It happened very early in the pregnancy and resolved on its own. Lana didn't suffer physical pain, and she was only 32. We had plenty of time to try again. The hardest part was calling our families with the bad news only a week after we delivered the good news. Our families reacted the same way. Nothing but positivity, love, support, and encouragement. I'm not even sure the second miscarriage counts. We're the type of couple that can't wait for anything. If I get Lana a Christmas gift in November, I have to run home and give it to her within 2 hours. If I have a surprise for her, I can't hold it in, and vice versa. I think Lana was doing a pregnancy test just about every hour. Every CVS and Rite Aid within a 5-mile radius was cleared out of EPTs and first response tests because of us. One day, the Styx had a faint double line in the window. The next day, the line was gone. If we hadn't been testing obsessively, we might have never known or even gotten our hopes up. So now we were 0-for-2, but contrary to my usual default setting, I wasn't worried. I headed off any anxiety by trying to figure out how to make a miscarriage story funny. I don't touch a lot of social issues or politics in my stand-up, leaving those topics to people who are better informed than me. But in my act, I am drawn to dealing with awkward and awful situations in one's personal life, and the puzzle of how to turn tragedy into comedy. What would be the angle? How could I tell a joke about illness, death, or divorce? What observations could I make about miscarriage that other people would relate to and laugh at? It's not like Lana and I were the only people dealing with it. Serial miscarriage is devastating and frustrating. And when it's happening to you, it is all you could think about. But people don't talk about it. First, you keep the pregnancy a secret for 12 weeks. If you don't get that far, you have a second secret on top of the first. Since a miscarriage is sad and upsetting and rolled up with self-blame and feelings of inadequacy, you swallow the bad feelings instead of airing them out. Sometimes it's better to leave bad experiences untouched. Let it alone. But for me, as a comedian, my mind automatically goes there. How could I turn a sadness like that into something funny in any way, shape, or form? I'd be airing it out for my own sake, but also for anyone who'd been there too. I haven't worked our miscarriages into my act yet. I may never. But it's worth thinking about. After the second false alarm, Lana's OBGYN told us to wait before we tried again. She said that Lana's body needed to recover and reset itself to be ready for a new pregnancy. How long do we have to wait? Asked Lana. The doctor said, until you have a normal cycle, which could possibly be a few months or more. Seemed like a long wait, too long. Another doctor told Lana it was fine to go ahead and try. We didn't intend to go against her OBGYN's orders, but we figured you could plan on it all day long. But if and when the timing is right, it will happen. Literally 3 weeks after the doctor told us not to try, Lana said at breakfast that morning, I think I'm pregnant. Immediately, I drove to the nearest pharmacy and filled up a basket with dozens of pregnancy tests. I had to get the digital one, the one that says pregnant instead of the ones with the lines. These are not clear enough for me. In a world of emojis, I think they need to come out with the iPreg, an app where you urinate on the camera lens, and if you're pregnant, a digital infant will dance across the screen. Drugstore tests are too subtle and need an update. Lana basically spent the morning on the toilet, drinking water and peeing on every stick in the bag. Parallel lines, plus sign, they all said the same thing. definitely pregnant. We were thrilled, but based on prior experiences, we didn't let our hopes get too high. We wanted to be excited, but we knew the harsh truth about what could happen. I wouldn't say we were pessimistic, more likely cautiously optimistic. We lived for 3 whole months in that limbo between allowing yourself to be happy and keeping your emotions in check. We told no one close to us. The only people besides the doctor who knew were the nail lady at Pampered Hands. Lana had to make sure she didn't use any harmful products. Her Pilates teacher, no harmful exercises. And the guy at the juice shop, no harmful ingredients. We got the official go-ahead at 11 weeks, along with the gender. A girl. Lana intended to wait 3 days until she saw her mother in person. But who were we kidding? We FaceTimed her mom immediately and then shared the news with the rest of our family and friends. Our next big project was in development. We were having a baby. If one person in a relationship goes on a diet, it'll never work. It has to be to both of you. Once I told Lana I want to do a juice cleanse, and she said, but I don't want to. I wasn't asking her to do it, but by her logic, if I did a week-long juice cleanse, we wouldn't be able to go out to restaurants. We wouldn't cook together, which we love to do, or have nice wine at night. Forget dinner dates with friends or sitting around the kitchen table with coffee. I wouldn't have the energy to take long walks or go for a run with her. By doing a cleanse, I'd be depriving her and us of the things we enjoy doing together. By the same token, if one person is eating no holds barred, including stuff she'd typically avoid like ice cream and donuts, then the other person has to eat it all too. I made the decision early on in the pregnancy that I'd partake. So if Lana said to me, I'm going to order some ice cream to be delivered, you want any? The answer was, yeah. Ordering ice cream at night became a pattern during the pregnancy. If a wife is going to have a bowl of it in bed at 9 p.m., then as a good husband, you better be right there next to her. Pregnancy gave me the excuse to feel liberated to eat whatever I wanted without guilt. There were no juice cleanses during this time, to say the least. We basically did a world tour of cuisines from the comfort of our own home, thanks to Postmates, a delivery service where you could get any meal from any restaurant brought to your door. Lana's only food restriction was no raw fish or rare meat. So when we got the craving for sushi, we ordered from Nobu, and she'd have rolls of cooked fish like eel and shrimp. She often craved steak. So I had recently learned how to cook it properly. I used to just throw a steak on the grill, and it always came out uneven. The outside would burn, and the inside was raw. I researched online the perfect method for getting a nicely seared, evenly cooked medium-rare steak by doing it slow at low temperature to allow the meat to retain the juices. My recipe. Step 1. Preheat the oven to 275 degrees. Step 2. Season the steak with salt and pepper. Step 3. Put in an oven-safe pan and roast for 45 minutes. Step 4. Take it out and let it rest for 15 minutes. Step 5. Sear the meat on a dry, hot cast iron pan. No oil, no butter, for 2 minutes on each side. Always juicy and delicious. Try it. Our favorite nighttime snack is popcorn. My wife makes an unbelievable batch in the Whirly Pot, a pot with a churner inside for perfect popping. She puts a little vegetable oil in the pot, heats it up, and then pours in Boulder Popcorn's Cambria's Cream small kernels and starts whirling. When it's done, it goes in a bowl, lightly salted. During the pregnancy, we were knocking down bowls of it every night. I know some expectant fathers complain behind their wife's back about how much they're packing away. I was glad Lana was indulging. I figured if she was eating, the baby was eating too. And so was I. The results were all too predictable. When Serafina was born, in April 2016, I was the heaviest I'd ever been, at 208 pounds. I gained 23 pounds during the 9 months of Lana's pregnancy, which was nearly the same amount she gained. I'm down to 198, only 13 pounds to go. Ideally, I'll lose it before Lana gets pregnant again, before I go right back up. Our pregnancy was all about staying home and eating, watching ourselves get bigger, and charting the baby's growth. I went to every doctor's visit and saw each sonogram. I would make commentary videos to send around. I was fascinated by the heartbeat and the changes on the monitor from visit to visit. Lana subscribed to a pregnancy website that described the baby size in utero week to week. At 8 weeks, the baby is the size of a clove of garlic. At 12 weeks, the baby's the size of a lime. At 16 weeks, the baby's the size of an avocado. Why was I suddenly craving guacamole? Toward the middle of the pregnancy, we hired a doula. A doula, in case you don't know, is a woman who talks you through the pregnancy and childbirth, explains things, answers questions, and gives you emotional support. I asked my wife, "Is the doula a nurse?" "No," she said. "Is she a doctor?" "No." "Is she a trained expert?" "She has a few kids of her own." "And how much does this cost?" "I'm not sure, but it's priceless." "What?" I knew better than to argue with a pregnant woman, so I just casually asked if we really needed a doula, and Lana insisted that, yes, we did. My wife's family does a lot of things that are unfamiliar to me. They got staff. They hire a gardener, a housekeeper, and apparently a doula. Goes without saying that when I was born, the doula was my mom. So this woman shows up at the house with yoga balls and diagrams of the female reproductive system. The icing on the cake was the stuffed animal placenta. She showed us different techniques to help with the birthing process and gave us an overview of how the delivery might go down. Lana and I acted like 13-year-olds in sex ed. We literally were dying laughing the entire time. The doula was around 38 and was very soothing, a real earth mother type. Lana intended to try to give birth without drugs. So the doula taught her techniques to lessen the pain of childbirth, and she had Lana do exercises on the yoga ball. She'd sit on it and spread her legs to take the pressure off the hips and roll on it. For weeks, the doula came over and taught Lana a bunch of these techniques. Would any of them work? We'd have to wait until she went into labor to find out. I sat there watching all this, thinking it was a scam. When my mom gave birth to me, I was 10.5 pounds. She had no drugs, no doula, and barely a husband to help. Lana's due date was May 1st, but on April 24th, a week early, the doctor said she was concerned about Lana's fluid levels. If they got too high, the baby could be in danger. She suggested inducing labor, and Lana was all for it at that point. My wife was ready for the baby to come out and didn't need to wait one more week for labor to start naturally. So before it even started, the no-drugs labor was getting a medical intervention. We didn't go over that decision with the doula. There was nothing to discuss. If the baby was at risk at all, the all-natural plan got thrown out the window. We arrived at Cedars-Sinai Hospital at 12:40 p.m. Lana was treated with Cervidil to get the process started, along with a Foley balloon in her cervix to open it up. I realized that all the discussion and planning about how the birth was going to go was really just something to do to prepare mentally. When it came down to pure physical labor, none of that mattered or even came into play. Lana started having bad contractions right away after she was induced.
but she wanted to hold out as long as she could without the epidural. After an hour, she said, "This is ridiculous. I need something." "Oh, the yoga ball?" I asked. "Fuck the yoga ball," she said. "I need the epidural." My wife is extremely strong and tough. She could run for 5 miles straight uphill, and she never mentions anything about pain. So for her to say she needed relief told me that she was in agony. I knew the contractions were killing her, and all I could do was stand there and watch it happen. Hey, I wanted to help, but how? Every father must feel as frustrated and powerless as I did in that room. I couldn't wait for the anesthesiologist to show up with the needle. When he finally arrived, I was almost as relieved as Lana. I heard the epidural needle was 6 inches long. It had to penetrate her skin and muscle to go between vertebrae. Medicine was injected into the spinal cord, and any pain she felt below the waist would be gone. My mother didn't have an epidural. Maybe they gave her a leather strap to bite down on, I don't know. In those days, fathers weren't in the delivery room either. Matter of fact, I think my father was at the salon in the middle of a perm. I wasn't going anywhere, but that didn't mean I wanted to watch the needle go into Lana. They put a sheet up to keep the area sterile, and I stayed on the other side of it. I guess I could have been the dork who says, "Oh, I'm curious how this works. Can I watch the procedure?" No way. If I would have seen the procedure, I might have passed out, and then there would have been 2 patients in the room. Lana's relief was immediate. The pain wasn't completely gone, she said, but it was a lot better. She got a walking epidural so she could get out of bed and move if she needed to go to the bathroom. I was so relieved that my wife was comfortable. I could finally relax. Believe it or not, after the epidural, we actually slept for a few hours. Lana in the bed and me on the couch in the hospital room. I remember my mother-in-law shaking me awake to tell me things were progressing fast and that it was almost time. Based on what we've seen in the movies and TV, I thought the room was going to be packed like a sold-out show with 10 or 12 people in there, nurses running around, orderlies, candy stripers. But it was nothing like that. There was just the doctor and 2 nurses, Lana, me, and my mother-in-law, Simone. Lana started to push, and in my head I was thinking, where is everyone? Who's working the monitor? Who's going to dab Lana's brow with a cold compress? By now, the contractions were coming every 2 minutes. Lana would say, "I feel one coming," and the graph on the screen would confirm that she was accurate. "Push," the doctor said. "Push like you're taking a poop." So she'd push and do the breathing, and when the contractions subsided, she'd catch her breath, and we'd just hang out. Talk about things like the stock market, or if we needed a few more throw pillows on the couch. Then, push, 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 and I'd ask, "What are you in the mood for dinner? I'm sort of in the mood for tacos or ramen." Lana said, "As long as it's not hospital food." "Okay, okay, here comes another." Then push, 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 and then relax. "Hey, baby," I'd ask, "you talk to the gardener about that agave plant?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah, we need to change the sprinkler settings," she said. "It's getting too much water." "Okay, great, babe. I'll get right in on that." "Oh, wait, 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 I think I feel another. Push, 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 push." Like that. Shockingly casual. I also thought, based on movies, that 2 pushes would do it, and the baby would shoot out. Not true. After 10 cycles of pushing, I stopped counting. I thought there'd be chaos and people shouting out hospital code and monitor readings. It was actually extremely quiet in there. I remember I was holding my wife's foot and the nurse was holding the other one. During one contraction in the beginning, I was looking up at Lana's face and she said, "You can't look at me while I'm doing this." She made Simone and me look out the window because she said it's too awkward for us to see her shit face. So I kept holding her foot, and when she had a contraction, I'd look out the window. Then she'd say, "Okay, done." Contraction passed, and I could look at her again. I kept this up, gazing out the window like a fool and then back at her for 1.5 hours. I remember seeing the Hollywood sign out the window and thinking, wow, I came out here 18 years ago with nothing, wanting to give the comedy business a try. Never did I imagine I'd be looking at that sign, holding my wife's swollen ankles while my daughter's head was halfway out of her vagina. When the baby crowned, I wasn't sure I wanted to watch. But I looked anyway, and saw Serafina's head emerge. It was just the top at first, and then the whole cranium popped out. The doula had warned us that the baby's soft skull sort of collapsed to fit through the birth canal. Serafina was a conehead. I thought, holy shit, that's a huge head. Was it gonna stay that way? Lana needed to plan some hairstyles that would flatter a pointy head. A couple pushes later, the body came out. That's my daughter, I thought, and started bawling. I mean, bawling. At moments like that, I can't control my feelings. And why would I want to? Seeing my daughter's birth was beautiful, unforgettable. I could only describe it as an uncontrollable joy. The nurses and the doctors started wiping her down, getting the mucus out of her nose and mouth, cleaning off her little body. It happened real fast. The doctor put a pair of scissors in my hand and told me to cut the umbilical cord. I was nervous to do it, thinking it might hurt Lana or Serafina, but I did it anyway, while still ugly crying with my open mouth. When I realized what the texture was like, I thought, I got this. The texture felt just like a piece of calamari. Then the baby was on Lana's chest, and I circled them both with my arms. Our relatives knew the gender, but we hadn't told anyone the name. Serafina Simone. Lana had designed a little embroidered patch that was sewn onto a little cotton hat. Oh, that's right. The embroidery guy also knew the name, and Lana made him swear to secrecy. I had the hat in my pocket and put it on the baby's head. At that moment, my mother-in-law found out we had named our daughter after her. Needless to say, she started bawling too. We hired Carrie, a night nurse, to educate us on what to expect. Sleep training, bottles, bathing, everything. She was basically our baby therapist. She and Lana would talk for hours every night about all things infant. To be honest with you, at first I was uncomfortable with Carrie being there. A stranger sleeping on the couch in my newborn baby's room? Shouldn't we be going through the trials and tribulations of raising the baby by ourselves? That was how my parents did it. But then again, unlike Mom and Dad, Lana and I didn't have a lot of family around to help us. My mother had moved to Los Angeles by then, but she lived about 45 minutes away. Not, Mom, I need you now, distance. And regardless, my mom is fun grandma. She comes to play, not to implement schedules. When you don't have immediate assistance, you hire people. Despite my initial hesitation, I quickly came to see Carrie as a blessing. She taught us what we needed to know and did whatever she could to help us get a decent night's sleep. Being a father played into all my anxieties. As a new parent, you're always concerned. Should we swaddle the baby? Should the baby be doing that? Is that a rash? What's that mark on her cheek? What does all this mean? Having a pro right there in your house to bounce stuff off eased our way into parenthood. Any questions my wife had during the day about breastfeeding, napping, you name it, were bounced off Carrie via text or a phone call or when she came in. She obviously knew what she was doing. Carrie had Serafina sleeping through the night at 6 weeks old. During our non-sleeping hours, we didn't leave the baby's side. Lana was breastfeeding, so she was literally attached to Serafina every 2 hours. My father had been old school, leaving the grosser parts of parenthood, diaper changing, cleaning spit up, to my mom. I was not going to emulate my father in that way. I did it all. One morning, I was bringing Serafina to Lana for her morning feed. I had no shirt on, and Serafina latched onto my nipple. I didn't know how to take this, but I laughed it off and did some extra bench presses for the next 2 weeks. As a father, you need to define your role. My role became the butler to my wife. Lana would sit down to breastfeed, and I would get her all the things she needed one by one. She would say, "Babe, could you please bring me my phone and a water?" "Right away, ma'am," I'd say. As soon as I would sit down, she would throw me another, "Hey, baby."
Yeah, honey.
"Could you please grab the frozen grapes?"
"Right away, my love."
I didn't dare say no, because she had literally grown this magical little human in her belly and was giving Serafina all of the nutrients she needed to keep growing. I really came to appreciate and understand the role of a mother, and being her butler was the least I could do. If Lana and I went into a different room when Serafina was napping, we watched her on our phones via the live streaming app that connected to the Nest camera by her crib. Whenever I was out of the house for any reason, I would find myself checking the baby camera app constantly. It was addicting. At any time, I could look at my daughter and see that she was safe. Serafina was 10 days old when we decided to have our first dinner out. I knew plenty of people who, after becoming parents, never carved out any time for themselves. We once met this couple for dinner, and they said, "Oh my God, this is the first time we've been out since the baby was born a year and a half ago." I said, "You couldn't get a babysitter?" My buddy said, "Babysitters are expensive." I almost said, "You think babysitters are expensive? How about marriage counselors?" We stayed in a lot more than usual during the pregnancy, and now I wanted to go out. It's important to get a little break. Our lives were centered around the baby, but if we didn't get a few hours to detach once in a while, we were going to go nuts. I said to Lana, "Why not go out and eat instead of sitting here watching the baby sleep? We have the help." So Lana, my mother, and I went to Il Piccolino for dinner. It was only a 5-minute drive from the house. As soon as we sat down, Lana opened the app and checked the baby. In the grainy black and white picture, it looked like the blanket was covering the baby's face. We called Carrie, but she didn't answer. "What the fuck? Where is she? Sleeping? Does Carrie have a blanket over her head too?" I was boiling, but trying not to stress Lana out too much. We even did the walkie-talkie through the Nest cam, but we were getting no response. We told each other, "Sure, it's fine," and tried to go on with our dinner. But Lana was crawling out of her skin. She said, "What do we do?" We tried calling and texting a few times to no avail. There was no way we could continue our dinner assuming everything was okay. I told Lana, "Go home and check the baby. We'll stay here." About 10 minutes later, my mother and I watched on my phone as Lana walked into the baby's room and checked the crib. She texted, "All good." It was just the angle of the camera that made it look as if the blanket was over her face. When Lana got back to the restaurant, she told us that Carrie had turned off the ringer to let the baby sleep. We all decided from then on that the ringer was on when we were out. My mother said, "When you were a baby, you didn't have a camera in your room." "Yeah, no kidding, Ma. Just ask our neighbors from back in the day." My parents had no idea what was going on in my room after they tucked me in. One time when I was around 10, I sleepwalked out the screen door, hopped a short fence, and ran through dewy grass in my Pittsburgh Steelers pajamas. I think I was dreaming about being Franco Harris running down the field, but I was running down Shagbark Lane to my next-door neighbors Bonnie and Frank's house. My parents had no idea that I was even gone. So Bonnie was around 40 years old at the time, and I knocked on the door and she answered in her negligee. Theirs was the house in the neighborhood that nobody ever saw the inside of. Maybe it was the mystery that lured me there in my sleep. So she invited me in. I do remember getting a glimpse into their entry and seeing two mantled, armored knights standing there like something out of the medieval times. As I progressed through the house, it looked like a mix of King Arthur and Scarface, lots of black and red with dim lighting. She took me into her bedroom with a gold rotary phone and gold silk sheets on the bed. It looked like the movie producer's bedroom in The Godfather. The only thing that was missing was the horse's head. My father is the type of sleeper where he didn't budge until his internal alarm clock woke him up for work. My parents were sound asleep, comfortable. They had a water bed. It had a mirrored canopy. I think my dad got a deal on it from a porno set clearance sale. When you're a kid, you just think the mirrored bed is sort of cool. To this day, I've never had a conversation with my parents about this. How do you even bring that up over breakfast? Hey, Ma, do you like the mirrored bed because... Never mind. Just pass the biscuits. So how this went down was Bonnie called my house and said to my Ma, do you know your son is in my bedroom right now? Needless to say, my parents were clueless that Bonnie and I were hanging out in our PJs in her bedroom next door. Mom said, what do you mean? Nobody in the Arlington Heights vicinity has ever made it past your welcome mat. I've been dying to see the inside of your house for 15 years. How did Sebastian get an invite? Rose, he didn't, said Bonnie. He sleepwalked over here. Can you come get him, please? Only if you show me your front room. That will never happen with Serafina, because we will get an alert if she so much as twitches. Obviously, human babies have survived until adulthood without cameras in their faces 24/7. But the technology exists now, so we were going to use it. I knew it was intrusive and might cause more anxiety than it quelled, but I liked being able to look at my baby to see what she was doing when I was away from home. And that was how we were going to raise her. I realized that dinners out from now on were going to be with phones on the table and camera apps open. Our lives were completely changed. We'd been to this restaurant millions of times, not a care in the world. Before, we'd have pasta and a glass of wine and talk to each other. Now, as soon as we sat down, we were glued to the app, trying to see breathing movements. Before, we lingered between courses. Now, Lana raced home to check the baby. Sometimes, as a new parent, you need to be crazy. You need to check in. You assume nothing. Your baby is your heart existing outside your body. This is a whole new level of responsibility that I'd never had before, and it hit me full force. It took me 43 years to get here, but I was ready for this. When Serafina smiles, she looks like Lana. When she's annoyed with people, she looks like me. When I'm there, Lana and I wake up the baby together. As soon as she sees us, she starts smiling and kicking her feet and flailing her arms in cheer. I jump out of bed to see that. In my previous life, I would never get out of bed so early for anything. But the promise of seeing Serafina focus in and freak out in happiness is the best alarm clock in the world. Even if she's hungry or has gas and starts crying, it's exciting to see this little tiny person expressing herself with such gusto. Now, making people laugh has long been my connection to humanity. If I can make you smile or crack up, we are bonded, at least for that moment. I feel the energy pass between us. When I play a large venue like the Mohegan Sun, I feel that energy times 10,000. Well, making Serafina laugh is like 10,000 Mohegan Suns. It's the greatest joy of my life. She smiles at me, and I'm done. I travel all of the time for work, and it has become painful to leave home. I was in New York recently to scope out some locations for my next special, and every second I wasn't in a meeting, I played a video that Lana sent me of Serafina in the little activity chair that we call her desk, laughing. I put it on a loop and lost an hour before I realized what had happened. Since I had a baby, it's been hard to get anything done. My friends with older kids tell me to enjoy every moment. I already have a sense that this is going to go by real fast. One day, she lifts her head. The next, she rolls over. The next, she's off to college. Right now, she might be grabbing my shirt and spitting up on my shoulder. But in a blink, she'll be asking me, Dad, aren't you embarrassed? I can't wait to get to know this little tiny person who already can make me melt with the way she just bats her eyes. And now, I'm welling up again. I'm new at this, but I have figured out a few things about fatherhood. It has doubled my joy and anxiety. It's put a permanent lump in my throat, and it involves a lot of crying. By me. Chapter 12. Acting Chops. In the last few years, I've noticed that I'm getting a lot of calls about acting. Ironically, when I first started out as a performer, acting was what convinced me to go out west to L.A. I wanted to do stand-up, but all my experience was in theater. After graduating college, I was in a very different boat from my friends. They lined up jobs in the fields that they majored in. Basically, nothing in my life had been planned besides the dream of being a comedian. I majored in corporate organizational communications. The reason I majored in this was because it was the only major that didn't require a test to get in. Out of college, I've been working as a temp at United Airlines Employees Credit Union. My job was to enter codes for pre-ordered specialty meals into the system. There's nothing more boring than entering in the code for an airline meal ordered by a stranger in 32B. If you flew on United Airlines in the early 90s and received Salisbury steak instead of the vegetarian meal you requested, it was because I was working the graveyard shift and I didn't give a shit. The last thing I was concerned about is who was pissed off about the meal mix-up on the way to Dulles International. During this job hell, I saw an ad in a local paper looking for actors to appear in an interactive dinner theater production in Chicago. I had never done anything like that before, but sometimes when you don't know what to expect, you're better off. It was for a show called Joey and Mary's Irish-Italian Comedy Wedding, like Tony and Tina's wedding, but with an Irish twist. I auditioned for the part of best man, Gino Capellini. I went into the audition and knocked it out of the park, just being me. I had no fear or expectations. I just did it because I thought it'd be fun, and they gave me the part right in the room. I took my place in the cast of real theater actors who were in the Steppenwolf Theater Company, a prestigious notch on any actor's belt. While these people were studying acting meticulously, I was pretending to care about my corporate organizational communications degree, which must have indirectly given me some acting chops. I had no formal acting training at all, but what I did have was the bluster of youth and positive prior experience being on stage in front of a large group of people and making them laugh. Back in college, there was this bodybuilding contest called Greek Physique. All the fraternities and sororities would do a skit, and then one representative from each house would come out and pose. I wasn't the bodybuilder for my frat, but I did write the skit and MC the event, and I killed it. I figured Joey and Mary's wedding would be an extension of that. I was still living at my parents' house in the burbs, so I had to drive into the city for daily rehearsals. The director's plan was to do shows at different banquet halls around the Chicago area. We'd go into a catering hall in, say, Addison, Illinois, turn the space into a wedding set, tables, a DJ, a cake, flowers, and put on a show. If you hadn't experienced interactive dinner theater, you really need to do it once. The concept is you're attending a real wedding reception as a guest. You sit at an assigned seat at a table with other people, some of whom are actors. The more you get into it and play along, the more fun you're going to have. There was a loose script, but pretty much it was up to each actor to get the people involved in the drama. I would jump right in at my table with typical wedding icebreakers like, "Which side are you on? I haven't seen you in the family, so you must be with the bride." Or I'd say to a woman, "I saw you looking at me, but I got a girlfriend, so back off." You had to be willing to play with me for a joke to work, but a lot of people wouldn't say anything. They'd get embarrassed, and Gino Campolini, would have to monopolize the conversation. There's a hilarious episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm when Larry David went to an interactive show like this, and he knew one of the actors. He kept trying to get the guy to break character. When they were in the bathroom together, Larry said, "So, John, how you been?" The guy said, "Who's John?" Larry wouldn't let it go, and chaos ensued. When my family came to the show, it was a real challenge for me to stay in character. I'd see my mom was on the dance floor, and I'd have to say, "Hey, how you doing? I'm Gino Campolini." She'd crack up, and I'd say, "What's so funny? I got something in my teeth?" In the middle of the evening, the Irish brother of the groom and I broke out into a dance number, and we always brought the house down. We did 12 Saturday night shows in a row. Gino had a girlfriend named Jody, played by an actress I got to be friends with, and we'd go out with the rest of the cast after a show to party at somebody's house, at a bar, or what have you. I had a ball doing the show. It was an unforgettable summer for a 22-year-old kid. But as far as acting goes, I wouldn't say that I learned a lot. Maybe I picked up more than I would have doing improv, but not much. There was no dialogue to memorize. My costume was a tux. All I had to do was eat and talk and dance, skills that were already in my wheelhouse. It got my feet wet in dealing with an ensemble of actors and actresses, and I outshined a lot of them. I consistently made people laugh. I thought I could perform. I could make people happy. The whole experience spurred me to pursue performing for real. I've been thinking about moving off to Los Angeles for a few months, but I hadn't been able to pull the trigger. Getting the Gino role and doing it well gave me the confidence to say, I might have something here. I think performing could be a career. It was not like I was landing any other jobs at the time. The writing was on the wall early that I was not cut out for a cubicle. I thought it was because I wasn't a good fit at the Chicagoland Convention Hall career day. In hindsight, I think what turned off potential employers was my metallic silver double-breasted three-piece suit with red handkerchief and matching red tie from Taylor Street, while everybody else was in navy business suits and getting hired left and right. I looked like John Travolta from Saturday Night Fever going on career day. I had no guidance. Nobody put me in check. My father thought I looked sharp, and my mother thought I would get a career as a model. After landing nothing at career day, I began thumbing through newspapers, and the ads for musical theater kept glaring at me. I just felt bad for my parents because their friends and neighbors got to brag about the cush jobs their kids were landing. Mine would have to act as if they were proud that I was making less than minimum wage at a part-time gig, after they'd gone through 2 years of what they called mall withdrawal to save to put me through college. Most parents had an education fund for their children, so when the time came, it was ready to roll. Mine began saving 3 weeks before orientation. The best part of my family is that there's a lot of love, no pressure, and we go with the flow. My parents were supportive of my Joey and Mary gig. And, in all honesty, I was the star of the show. This didn't make me think, next stop, Scorsese. But the summer as Gino did give me a boost and motivate me to go west. It only made sense. I booked it right off the bat and then kept up with the serious veteran actors. Speaking of professionals in the cast, I saw the guy who played Joey in New York about 3 years ago at Eataly, an Italian food marketplace, where he was selling coffee beans. 20 years ago, we had the same dream, and we were on the same path together. No slam on Joey. He's got his own business and seems happy. I just think it's interesting to see where people end up after they give up on their dream. Maybe the only difference between me and him is that I didn't give up, no matter how frustrated and full of doubt I felt at times. When I first arrived in L.A., I'd sent my headshots to 1,000 people, as you know. I resent them to hundreds, including casting offices at soap operas. When I mailed to General Hospital, I put a post-it note right above my face, and it read, "Casting, I'm ready to operate." I just couldn't send a picture without a pun. It's like a sickness. They must have liked my enthusiasm, because a week later, I got called in to be office worker number 4. The job was to enter the office set with a folder and say, "Where do you want me to file this, boss?" It was my network television debut. My mother told everybody she knew. My father asked, "You get paid?" "Yeah, up front." Right after, "Cash." They paid $234 for the day by check, which was the equivalent of 2 8-hour shifts at the Four Seasons. That meant I could work one less shift at the lounge and devote the time to comedy instead. Everything related back to comedy and earning enough to do it. Being an extra on soaps seemed like a gold mine. I needed more of that. I let the GH Extras casting person know that I was available and ready to work. I'd carry a whole box of folders if they needed me to. I started getting regular spots on GH, Days of Our Lives, and Port Charles, in a wide range of parts with no emotional depth, like cop number 2, surgeon number 1, or patron number 3. Every part came with a number. The only number I cared about was $234. Being an extra isn't anything close to acting, but there's no shame in being part of the scenery. In the industry, extras prefer being thought of as atmosphere. I didn't care what they called me. These jobs were cake. I'd show up at 9:30 a.m., put on my costume, hang around until 2 or 3, eat for free, get the call to walk across the set, occasionally deliver a single line of dialogue like, "You're under arrest," or "Scalpel, stat," then clock out and get paid. In addition to stand-up and soaps, I auditioned for roles in sitcoms. The first thing I learned was that the sitcom auditions were cattle calls. I'd walk into the room and find 15 or 20 actors, all the same age, all of us with more or less the same look, all of us desperate to book a part in a sitcom that usually amounted to one scene with 5 or 6 lines tops, if you were lucky. I'd walk into these casting sessions, look around the room at all the other actors, and ask myself, how the hell are these producers going to tell us apart? I had to distinguish myself in some way, separate myself from the pack. I'll use my marketing chops, I thought. They already had my headshot. What could I send them that would make them remember me? A pizza. I tried it once and sent a pizza to the casting director named Penny with a note, "Thank you for seeing me. Enjoy your lunch." My friend Mike played the delivery guy. He walked into the room carrying the pie and said, "Hey, Penny, I'm out here 10 years delivering pizza, and this guy comes in the shop just now, orders a pie to go for you. He wanted you to have it. Open it up." He put the pepperonis into a cent sign for Penny. Unbelievable. We started talking. "Funniest guy I've ever seen in my life. You seen this guy?" "Yeah," she said. "We just saw him. Thanks for the tip. We're going to go in a different direction, but leave the pie." They did not give me a callback or a part. I really thought someone would offer me a job because of the creative combo of inventiveness and pepperonis. For me, hope springs delusional. Since my extra work on GH, I picked up a few parts here and there over the years. A bouncer in a TV show called Complete Savages, and a low-rent gangster in Cruise, a small independent film. I watched comedians I came up with land TV development deals and star in sitcoms. Nothing like that happened for me. Until 2015. After 17 years in comedy, I finally got a deal with NBC to write the pilot episode of a sitcom based on my life called Sebastian Says. This deal was years in the making. My team and I cycled through a few writers and showrunners before we locked in with a writer named Austin Earl. Austin and I originally met in 2012 to talk about the possibility of collaborating on a sitcom. We hit it off and we wanted to work together, but right after our meeting, he got an exclusive gig